The National Sunday Law, The Argument of A.T. Jones Before the U.S. Senate Committee, December 1888, Part 5. Senator Blair, abolish the law of rest, take it away from the working people, and leave corporations and saloon keepers and everybody at perfect liberty to destroy that 24 hours of rest, and lawgivers and lawmakers will find out whether or not the people want it and whether they want those lawmakers. Mr. Jones, there are plenty of ways to help the working men without establishing a religious monopoly and enforcing religious observance upon all. There is another point that comes in right here. Those who are asking for the law and those who work for it are those who compel the people to work on Sunday. In the Illinois State Sunday Convention in Chicago last month, it was stated in the first speech made in the convention, quote, "We remember how that the working men are compelled to desecrate the Sabbath by the great corporations," close quote. The very next sentence was, quote, "We remember also that the stockholders, the owners of these railroads, are members of the churches, that they sit in the pews and bow their heads in the house of God on the Sabbath day," close quote. Senator Blair, that is only saying that there are hypocrites in this world. What has that to do with this proposed law? Mr. Jones, I'm coming to that. It has a good deal to do with it. The stockholders who own the railroads act in this way, those men said, and it was stated by a minister in that convention that a railroad president told him that there were more petitions for Sunday trains from preachers than from any other class. Senator Blair, there are a lot of hypocrites among the preachers then. Mr. Jones, precisely. Although you yourself have said it, I confess I have not the heart to dispute it. Senator Blair, I do not find any fault with that statement. If it is true, it does not touch this question. Mr. Jones, if these preachers and church members will not keep the Sabbath in obedience to what they say is the commandment of God, will they keep it in obedience to the command of the state? Senator Blair, certainly the hardworking man needs rest. The preachers, church members, and millionaires may do as they please. The bill comes in here and says that the national government, taking part of the jurisdiction of the civil government of the United States by a concession made by the states by virtue of its control of interstate commerce and the post office business and the Army and Navy, will take advantage of what the states have given to the general government in the way of jurisdiction and will not introduce practices which destroy the Sabbath in the states. That is the object of this legislation. That is all that is undertaken here. It is simply an act proposing to make efficient the Sunday rest laws of the state and nothing else. Mr. Jones, but those laws are to be enforced, if at all, by those who are so strongly in favor of them. Senator Blair, no, by the state. If these people were in favor of them, or not in favor of them, or violated them, that is another thing. A man may be for a law which he violates. A great many of the strongest temperance people in the world use intoxicating liquors. They say that they realize the evil and that they are in favor of the enactment of law which will expurgate those evils. The strongest advocates I have ever seen of temperance legislation are men who have come to realize that the grave is just ahead of them. They cannot get rid of the appetite, but they pray the government for legislation that will save the boys. Mr. Jones, that is all right. I am in favor of prohibition straight, but not Sunday prohibition. Senator Blair, you cannot adduce a man's practice as a reply to the argument on a question that touches the public good. It does not violate a man's principle because he fails to live up to it himself. Mr. Jones. But the secret of the whole matter is this. as an argument for the Sunday laws, these men assert that the great railroad corporations desecrate the Sabbath, and by persistently running Sunday trains, also compel the railroad men to work and to desecrate the day. They at the same time assert that the men who own the railroads belong to the churches. If then the railroads compel their men to desecrate the day, and the owners of the railroads are church members, then who is it but the church members that are compelling people to desecrate the day? Further than this, they quoted at Chicago the statement of a railroad president that the roads get more requests for Sunday trains signed by preachers than they do from other people. But as the church members own the railroads and the preachers request them to run Sunday trains, then who is to blame for the desecration of the day but the preachers and their own church members? Can't the preachers stop asking for Sunday trains without being compelled to do so by the civil law? In the Chicago Convention last month, November 20th and 21st, Dr. Knowles, who is the secretary of this National Sunday Law Union, said that by the influence of William E. Dodge, even after his death, the Delaware and Lackawanna Railroad Company had resisted the temptation to run trains on Sunday until the present year. But 500 ministers met in conference in New York and used competing lines on Sunday, and by this, the hands of the Sunday Observance Committee have been tied ever since. After that, when the Delaware and Lackawanna directors were asked not to run Sunday trains, they replied, quote, "How can you come to us pleading for us to run no trains on Sunday when your preachers by the hundreds on Sunday use our rival lines, which do run on Sunday? If your preachers ride on Sunday trains on other roads, we cannot see why they and other people cannot ride on our trains on Sunday. And if it's all right for these other roads to run trains on Sunday, and certainly ministers of the gospel would not ride on them if it were wrong, then we cannot see how it can be such a great wrong for us to run Sunday trains," close quote. That is a very proper answer. No wonder the Sunday committee's hands are tied by it. And yet that very conference of 500 preachers assembled in New York last summer took the first decided step toward organization of the National Sunday Association, of which Dr. Knowles himself is secretary. By these facts, there is presented the following condition of things. Number one, church members own the railroads. Number two, preachers sign requests for Sunday trains. Number three, the church members grant the request of the preachers for Sunday trains, and the preachers ride on the Sunday trains, and other church members go on Sunday excursions. Number four, then the whole company, preachers and church members together petition Congress and the state legislators to make a law stopping all Sunday trains. That is to say, they want the legislators, state and national, to compel their own railroad-owning church members not to grant the request of the preachers for Sunday trains. In other words, they want the civil power to compel them all, preachers and church members, to act as they all say that Christians ought to act. And they insist upon quoting all the time the commandment of God, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. But if they will not obey the commandment of God, which they themselves acknowledge and quote, what assurance have we that they will obey the law of Congress or state legislator when they get it, especially as it will rest entirely with themselves to see that the law is enforced? Will they compel themselves by civil law to do what they themselves will not otherwise do? The sum of this whole matter is that they want the civil power to enforce church discipline, and that not only upon themselves, but upon everybody else. The whole system and all the pretensions upon which this Sunday law is demanded are crooked. As to the enforcement of the law, it will fail to those who are working to get it, because certainly those who do not want it will not enforce it, and the officers of the law are not given to the enforcement of the laws which are not supported by public opinion. This is proved by the fact that the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago now have Sunday laws that ought to satisfy any reasonable person, and yet not one of them is enforced. And the preachers of that city and state, instead of seeing that these are enforced, call convention after convention to work up more Sunday laws, both state and national. What then is the next intention? It is to make it a political question in both state and nation, and make the enactment and enforcement of Sunday laws the price of votes and political support. This is proved by the following resolutions adopted by the Elgin Sunday Law Convention. Quote, resolved that we look with shame and sorrow on the non-observance of the Sabbath by many Christian people, in that the custom prevails with them of purchasing Sabbath newspapers, engaging and patronizing Sabbath business and travel, and in many instances giving themselves to pleasure and self-indulgence, setting aside by neglect and indifference the great duties and privileges which God's day brings them. Resolved that we give our votes and support to those candidates or political officers who will pledge themselves to vote for the enactment and enforcing of statutes in favor of the civil Sabbath. Close quote. Such a resolution as this may work in Illinois, though it is doubtful, but with their own statement made in that convention, it is certain that this resolution can never work under the Constitution of the United States. They stated in the convention that the Sabbath is the test of all religion. To demand that candidates or political officers shall pledge themselves to vote for the enactment and enforcement of statutes in favor of the Sabbath is, therefore, to require a religious test as a qualification for office. The National Constitution declares that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under this government. Consequently, no Sabbath or Sunday law test can ever be applied to any candidate for any national office or public trust. It is true that they use the word civil in the resolution, but that corresponds with much of their other work. There is not, and there cannot be, any such thing as a civil Sabbath. The Sabbath is religious holy, and they know it. And in all their discussion of this resolution and the subject generally in the convention, it was a religious institution and that only. Senator Blair, is there any other point you wish to present? Mr. Jones, there is another point. And that is that we will be sufferers under such a law when it is passed. They propose to put in an exemption clause. Some of them favor an exemption clause, but it would not in the least degree check our opposition to the law if 40 exemption clauses were put in, unless indeed they should insert a clause exempting everybody who does not want to keep it. In that case, we might not object so much. Senator Blair, you care not whether it is put in or not? Mr. Jones, there is no right whatever in the legislation, and we will never accept an exemption clause as an equivalent to our opposition to the law. It is not to obtain relief for ourselves that we oppose the law. It is the principle of the whole subject of the legislation to which we object, and an exemption clause would not modify our objection in the least. Senator Blair, you differ from Dr. Lewis? Mr. Jones, yes, sir. We will never accept an exemption clause as tending in the least to modify our opposition to the law. We as firmly and as fully deny the right of the state to legislate upon the subject with an exemption clause as without. Senator Blair, There are three times as many of you as of his denomination? Mr. Jones, yes, sir. There are nearly 30,000 of us, and we ask for no exemption clause. We stand wholly upon the principle of the question. There should be no exemption from a just law. If the law is right, it is wrong to exempt. In 1887, Mrs. Bateham herself wrote and printed a letter to Seventh-day believers, proposing in substance that if we would help them to secure a Sunday law, they would exempt us from its penalties. We replied then, as we reply now and always, we will not help you to put upon others what we would not have put upon ourselves. Senator Blair, you object to it? Mr. Jones, we object to the whole principle of the proposed legislation. We go to the root of the matter and deny the right of Congress to enact it. Senator Blair, you say that the proposed exemption does not make it any better? Mr. Jones, not a bit, because if the rightfulness of the legislation be admitted, then we admit that it is the right of a majority to say that such and such a day shall be the Sabbath or the Lord's Day, and that it shall be kept. The majorities change in civil government. The majority may change within a few years, may change, in fact, at any election, and then the people may say that the day which we believe should be kept must be observed, or they may say that this day shall not be kept. If we admit the propriety of the legislation, we must also admit the propriety of the legislation to the effect that a certain day shall not be kept, and it makes every man's observance of Sunday or otherwise simply the football of majorities. That has been the course of religious legislation from the formation of the papacy onward, and that is the end of religious legislation of all kinds everywhere. Senator Blair, do you not think there is a distinction between a majority in a monarchical government and a majority in a republican government? In a monarchical government, the majority is simply one man who has power, Mr. Jones. But in a republic, when you throw this subject into civil affairs, it makes a great deal of difference. Why, sir, we would object to the passage of a law enforcing the observance of the day which we keep, and to accept an exemption clause would only be to contradict ourselves. Allow me to illustrate this. There was a time when we did not keep the seventh day as the Sabbath. While we did not keep it, we had the right not to keep it. We became convinced that we ought to keep it, and we are now doing so. We have the right to keep it. More than this, we have the right, again, not to keep it if we choose not to keep it. But if, while keeping it, we should consent to the state's assumption of power to compel us to do that which we have the right to omit if we please, we would therein resign our freedom of religious faith and worship. If these people would only think on this question, they would see that they themselves cannot afford to consent to this legislation, much less demand it. No man can ever safely consent to legislation in favor of the form of faith or worship which he himself professes. In so doing, he resigns his right to profess some other form of faith if he should become convinced that other form is nearer the truth than his own. He virtually resigns his right to think any further on the subject of religious observances and must thenceforth accept them ready-made from the legislative power, that is, as the majority may dictate. The Sunday observers may thus give away their religious liberty if they choose, but as for us, we do not propose to do it. We are going to assert and maintain our rights, and when these give theirs away, we are going to assert their right to reassert their rights. Another thing, an exemption clause is only a toleration clause in disguise. For us to accept it would be to confess that all religious rights are summed up in the majority, and that we are willing to accept from them whatever religious liberty they think we ought to have, but no such confession, sir, will we ever make. To no such thing will we ever consent or submit. We are Americans, sir, and citizens of the United States, too, and we assert all the rights of American citizens. The vocabulary of American ideas knows no such word as toleration. It asserts rights. As we said by the Senate Committee on this very subject 60 years ago, so say we, quote, what other nations call religious toleration, we call religious rights. They are not exercised by virtue of governmental indulgence, but as rights of which government cannot deprive any portion of citizens, however small. Despotic power may invade those rights, but justice still confirms them, close quote. Nor is all this that there is to be said on this point. There is another principle involved. If we should accept the exemption clause, it would not help the thing. It would be exceedingly short. Suppose an exemption clause were given. There are people who would profess to be Seventh-day Adventists for the express purpose of getting a chance to open saloons or houses of business on Sunday. Therefore, in outright self-defense, the majority would have to repeal the exemption clause. Senator Blair, call Mr. Bateham's attention to that. Mr. Jones, let me repeat it. If you give an exemption clause, it has been tried. There are reprehensible men, saloon keepers, who know they will get more traffic on Sunday than they can on Saturday, and they will profess to be Seventh-day Adventists. They will profess to be Sabbath keepers. You cannot go behind the returns. You cannot look into the heart. You cannot investigate the intention to see whether they are genuine in their profession or not. They will profess to be Sabbath keepers. And then they will open their saloons on Sunday. Then in outright self-defense, to make your position effective, you will have to repeal that exemption clause. It will last but a little while. Senator Blair, I agree with you there. Mr. Jones, for that reason, these people cannot afford to offer an exemption clause. And for the reason that it puts the majority in the power of our conscience, we deny the right to do anything of the kind. I ask the organizations represented here to think of this after this hearing is over. It will bear all the investigation they choose to give to it. Senator Blair, I should like to call everyone's attention to the point. If you need any legislation of this kind, you would better ask for legislation to carry out your purposes and be careful that in the effort to get the assistance of the parties against you, you do not throw away the pith and substance of all for which you ask. Mr. Jones, yes, sir, that is the point. To show the workings of this principle, I will state that Arkansas, in 1885, had an exemption clause in its Sunday law. That exemption clause, it was claimed, was taken advantage of by saloon keepers to keep open on Sunday. A delegation went to the legislature of Arkansas and asked them to repeal the exemption clause so that they could shut the saloons on Sunday. The legislature did it. If they had shut the saloons on Sunday, that would have been well enough, but they did not even try it. There was not a saloon keeper arrested under that repealed law. There were only two men not keeping the seventh day who were arrested under it. There was not a man who did not keep the seventh day fined under it, but there were Seventh-day Baptists and some Seventh-day Adventists, poor almost as Job's turkey, who were prosecuted and fined. One man had his only horse taken from him and his cow, and at last his brethren contributed money to save him from jail. Such men were prosecuted time and again, and the lawyers of the state, under the leadership of Senator Crockett, succeeded in carrying through the legislature against the persistent opposition of the church managers a bill restoring the exemption clause to save these poor, innocent people from the persecution that was being carried on. Senator Blair, I am glad you put in that fact because it is something that happened. Mr. Jones, I asked to read the statement made in the Arkansas Legislature by Senator Crockett upon that very subject. Quote, let me, sir, illustrate the operation of the present law by one or two examples. A Mr. Swearingen came from a northern state and settled on a farm in county. His farm was 4 miles from town and far away from any house of religious worship. He was a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and after having scarcely observed the Sabbath of his people, Saturday, by abstaining from all secular work, he and his son, a lad of 17, on the first day of week, went quietly about their usual avocations. They disturbed no one, interfered with the rights of no one, but they were observed and reported to the grand jury, indicted, arrested, tried, convicted, fined, and having no money to pay the fine, these moral Christian citizens of Arkansas were dragged to the county jail and imprisoned like felons for 25 days. And for what? For daring in this so-called land of liberty in the year of our Lord, 1887, to worship God. Was this the end of the story? Alas, no, sir. They were turned out, and the old man's only horse, his sole reliance to make bread for his children, was levied on to pay the fine and costs, amounting to $38. The horse sold at auction for $27. A few days afterward, the sheriff came again and demanded $36, $11 balance due on fine and costs, and $25 for board for himself and son while in jail. And when the poor old man, a Christian, mind you, told him with tears that he had no money, he promptly levied on his only cow, but was persuaded to accept bond, and the amount was paid by contributions from his friends of the same faith. Sir, my heart swells to bursting with indignation as I repeat to you the infamous story. Another, and I am done, sir, I beg you and these senators to believe that these are neither fancy nor exaggerated sketches. 5 years ago, a young man, newly married, came to county from Ohio. He and his wife were Seventh-day Baptists. The young girl had left father and mother, brother and sisters, and all the dear friends of her childhood to follow her young husband to Arkansas, to them the land of promise. The light of love sparkled in her bright young eyes. The roses of health were upon her cheeks, and her silvery laugh was sweet music, of which her young husband never wearied. They purchased a little farm, and soon, by tireless industry and frugal thrift, their home blossomed like a rose in the wilderness. After a while, a fair young babe came to them to brighten the sunshine and sweeten the bird songs. They were happy in each other's affection and their love for the little one. For them, all things worked together for good, for in their humble, trusting way, they worshiped God and loved their fellow men. 2 years ago, the law under which their prosperity and happiness had had its growth was repealed. Accursed be the day which brought such a foul blot upon our state's fair fame. A change, sudden, cold, and blasting as an Arctic storm, came over their lives and pitilessly withered all their bright flowers of hope. Under this repeal, persecution lifted its ugly, venomous head. The hero of my sad story was observed by an envious, jealous neighbor, quietly working as he believed God had commanded him on Sunday. He was reported to that inquisitional relic of barbarism, the grand jury, indicted, tried, convicted, and thrown into jail because his conscience would not let him pay the fine. Week after week dragged its slow length along, Day after day, the young wife, with baby in her arms, watched at the gate for his coming, and like Tennyson's Mariana, she only said, "My life is dreary, he cometh not," she said. "I am weary, aweary, I would that I were dead." Then baby sickened and died. The light in the young wife's eyes faded out in tears. Her silvery laugh changed to low wailing sobs. Pale-faced, misery snatched the roses from her cheeks and planted in their stead her pallid hue. "Sir, how can I go on?" At length the cruel law was appeased, and this inoffensive citizen, except that he had loved God and sought to obey him, was released from prison and dragged his weary feet to the happy home he left a few short weeks before. He met his neighbors at the gate bearing a coffin. He asked no questions. His heart told him all. No, not all. He knew not. He could never know of her lonely hours, of her bitter tears, of the weary watching and waiting, of the appeals to God, that God for whom she had suffered so much, for help in the hour of her extremity, of her baby's sickness and death. He could not know of these, but he went with them to the quiet country burial place and saw beside the open grave a little mound with dirt freshly heaped upon it. And then he knew that God had taken both his heart's idols, and he was left alone. His grief was too deep for tears. With staring eyes, he saw them lower the body of his young wife into the grave. He heard the clods rattle upon the coffin, and it seemed as if they were falling upon his heart. The work was done, and they left him with his dead. And then he threw himself down between the graves with an arm across each little mound, and the tears came in torrents and kept his heart from breaking. And then he sobbed his broken farewell to his darlings and left Arkansas forever. Left it, sir, as hundreds of others are preparing to leave if this General Assembly fails to restore to them the protection of their rights under the Constitution, national and state. On next Monday at Malvern, 6 as honest, good, and virtuous citizens as live in Arkansas are to be tried as criminals for daring to worship God in accordance with the dictates of their own consciences, for exercising a right which this government under the Constitution has no power to abridge. Sir, I plead in the name of justice, in the name of our republican institutions, in the name of these inoffensive, God-fearing, God-serving people, our fellow citizens, and last, sir, in the name of Arkansas, I plead that this bill may pass and this one foul blot be wiped from the etching of our glorious commonwealth. Close quote. Arkansas was not alone in this. However, though it was worse there than anywhere else, I myself, with other brethren in California, had to send hundreds of dollars into Tennessee to support the families of the brethren of our own faith there, while the husbands and fathers who made the money for their support were in jail because they chose to work for their families on Sundays and make bread for them after having kept the Sabbath according to their conscience. That has been done, Mr. Chairman, in these United States. That is the care these people have for the laboring man. Senator Blair, you reason that there should be no Sunday law whatever? Mr. Jones, if you allow a Sunday law, you must allow it to any extent. It must be enforced. All they did in Arkansas was to enforce the law simply as in the Roman Empire they enforced the law and put Christians to death. They simply enforced the law, but the law was wrong. Any condition of the law that will allow such things as that is a wrong condition of the law. Senator Blair, this bill proposes that work must not be done to disturbance of others. This work was done to the disturbance of others. Mr. Jones, I know that this bill for a national Sunday law proposes that work must not be done to the disturbance of others, and in that very phrase lies one of its worst features. The bill declares that no person shall do any work or engage in any play, game, or amusement or recreation to the disturbance of others on the first day of the week, commonly known as the Lord's Day, or during any part thereof. This leaves it entirely with the other man to say whether that which I do disturbs him. And that is only to make every man's action on Sunday subject to the whim or caprice of his neighbor. And everybody knows that it requires a very slight thing to disturb one who has a spite or a prejudice against you. At the Illinois State Sunday Law Convention last month, November 2021, Dr. R.O. Post of Springfield made a speech on the subject of Sunday recreation, in which he declared as the sum of his whole speech that, quote, "There is no kind of recreation that is proper or profitable on Sunday outside of the home or the sanctuary," close quote. Only let such a law as it embodied in this bill become a force where R.O. Post is, and any kind of recreation outside of the home or the sanctuary would be sure to disturb him, and the one engaged in the recreation could be arrested and prosecuted. But it may be argued that no judge or jury would uphold any such prosecution. That is not at all certain, as we shall yet see. But whether or not it is so, it is certain that if your neighbor should say that what you did disturbed him, under such a law as that, he could have you arrested and put to the inconvenience and expense of defending yourself before the court. In 1887, the city of San Francisco, California, had an ordinance on another subject that embodied the very principle of this clause of this Sunday bill. It reads thus, quote, "No person shall in any place indulge in conduct having a tendency to annoy persons passing or being upon the public highway or upon adjacent premises," close quote. It is easy to see that the principle of his ordinance is identical with that of the clause in the first section of this bill, which forbids anything to the disturbance of others. While that San Francisco ordinance was in force, a man by the name of Fernando Pape was distributing some circulars on the street, which not only had a tendency to annoy, but actually annoyed a businessman across the street. Pappy was arrested. He applied to the Superior Court for a writ of habeas corpus, claiming that the offense charged against him did not constitute a crime, and that the ordinance making such an action an offense was invalid and void because it was unreasonable and uncertain. The report of the case says, quote, "The writ was made returnable before Judge Sullivan and argued by Henry Hutton in behalf of the imprisoned offender. Disposing of the question, the judge gave quite a lengthy written opinion in which he passed a somewhat severe criticism upon the absurdity of the contested ordinance and discharged Pappy from custody. Said the judge, if the order be law, enforceable by fine and imprisonment, it is a crime to indulge in any conduct, however innocent and harmless, in itself, and however unconsciously done, which has a tendency to annoy other persons. Instances might be multiplied indefinitely in which the most harmless and inoffensive conduct has a tendency to annoy others. If the language of the ordinance defines a criminal offense, it sets a very severe penalty of liberty and property upon conduct lacking in the essential element of criminality. But it may be said that courts and juries will not use the instrumentality of this language to set the seal of condemnation on unoffending citizens and to unjustly deprive them of their liberty and brand them as criminals. The law countenances no such dangerous doctrine, countenances no principle so subversive of liberty as that the life or liberty of a subject should be made to depend upon the whim or caprice of a judge or jury by exercising a discretion in determining that certain conduct does or does not come within the inhibition of a criminal action. The law should be engraved so plainly and so distinctly on the legislative tables that it can be discerned alike by all subjects of the commonwealth, whether judge upon the bench, juror in the box, or prisoner at the bar. Any condition of the law which allows the test of criminality to depend on the whim or caprice of a judge or juror savors of tyranny. The language employed is broad enough to cover conduct which is clearly within the constitutional rights of the citizen. It designates no borderline which divides the criminal from the non-criminal conduct. Its terms are too vague and uncertain to lay down a rule of conduct. In my judgment, the portion of the ordinance here involved is uncertain and unreasonable. Close quote. This decision applies with full force to this proposed national Sunday law. Under this law, all that would be necessary to subject any person to a criminal prosecution would be for him to engage in any sort of play game, amusement, or recreation on Sunday. Because the national reformers are as much in favor of this Sunday law as is anybody else. And there are many of those rigid national reformers who would be very much disturbed by any amusement or recreation indulged in on Sunday, however innocent it might be in itself. And it is left entirely to the whim or caprice of the disturbed one or of the judge or jury to say whether the action really has or has not disturbed him. The California decision is that such a statute sets a very severe penalty of liberty and property upon conduct lacking in the essential element of criminality. California courts countenance no such dangerous doctrine, countenance no principle so subversive of liberty or which so savors of tyranny as that which is embodied in these words of this Sunday bill. Nor is this confined to this particular section. The same principle is found in Section 5. This section provides that if any person works for any other person on Sunday and receives payment for it at any time, then any person in the wide world, except the parties concerned, can enter suit and recover the money so paid. If you work for me on Sunday and I pay you for it, then the first man that finds it out can sue you and get the money. That is what the bill says. When wages are paid for Sunday work, whether in advance or otherwise, the same may be recovered back by whoever shall first sue for the same. Whoever is a universal term. Therefore, this bill deliberately proposes that when any man who is subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States receives payment for work done on Sunday except for work of necessity or mercy, he may be sued for that money by whoever first learns that he has received it, and that person shall get the money. So much for this bill as it reads. Now, as to the work for which the Seventh-day Observers of Arkansas were prosecuted, it was not to the disturbance of others. Let me state some of the facts, the authentic record of which I have, but it is too voluminous to present in detail. With two exceptions, all the arrests and prosecutions were of people who observed the seventh day of the week as the Sabbath. And in these two exceptions, those who were held for trial were held without bail, simply on their own recognizance, and although the testimony was direct and positive, the jury agreed to disagree, and the cases were both dismissed, while in every case of a Seventh-day Adventist, the least bail that was accepted was $110. The most of them were held under bonds for $250, and some as high as $500. There was not a single case dismissed, and in all the cases, the complaint was never made that what was done had disturbed the worship or the rest of anyone. But the indictments were all for the crime of Sabbath breaking by the performance of labor on Sunday. The statute of Arkansas at that time ran thus, quote, Section 1883. Every person who shall on the Sabbath or Sunday be found laboring, or shall compel his apprentice or servant to labor or perform service other than customary household duties of daily necessity, comfort, or charity, on conviction thereof, shall be fined $1 for each separate offense. Section 1884. Every apprentice or servant compelled to labor on Sunday shall be deemed a separate offense of the master. Section 1885. The provision of this act shall not apply to steamboats and other vessels navigating the waters of the state, nor such manufacturing establishments as required to be kept in continual operation. Close quote. In the case of Mr. Swearingen, mentioned by Senator Crockett, the conviction was upon the testimony of a witness who swore that the work for which he was convicted was done on a day which proved to be 17 days before the law was enacted, thus by its enforcement making the law ex post facto. The Constitution of the United States forbids the making of ex post facto laws, but when a law, not being ex post facto in itself, made so by its enforcement, it is time that something was being done to enlighten courts and juries upon that subject, even though it should be by an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, providing that no law, not being ex post facto in itself, shall be made so by its enforcement. Then, on the other hand, several cases were tried, and the men convicted and fined after the law was repealed, though for the work done before. In almost every case, the informer, the prosecuting witness, or perhaps both, were men who were doing work or business on the same day, and sometimes with the very persons accused. Yet the man who kept the seventh day was convicted in every instance, while the man who did not keep the seventh day, but did work or business with the man who did, was left entirely unmolested, and his evidence was accepted in court to convict the other man. I give some instances. First, a man by the name of Millard Courtney, who was the prosecuting witness against two men, Armstrong and Elmore, had taken a man with him to where these men were working, and there they made a contract for roofing a schoolhouse, and yet Courtney's evidence convicted these two men of Sabbath breaking at the very time he was doing business with them. Second, J.L. Schottky was convicted upon the testimony of a man by the name of Hammond, who went to him on Sunday, where he was at work, and bargained with him for a Plymouth Rock rooster. Third, J.L. James, who worked in the rain for nothing on Sunday that a poor widow, a member of another church, might be sheltered, was convicted of Sabbath breaking upon the evidence of a man who carried wood and chopped it up that same day within 7 rods of the man who was convicted by his testimony. Fourth, one Lafever and his wife went to Ellen Meeks' house on Sunday to visit. They found Meeks planting potatoes. Meeks stopped planting potatoes and spent the rest of the day visiting with them, and yet Meeks was convicted of Sabbath breaking and fined upon the evidence of Lafever. Fifth, the second case of Mr. Meeks, Riley Warren, went to his house on Sunday to see him about hiring a teacher for the public school. In the social, neighborly conversation that passed between them, Meeks incidentally mentioned that he had mended his wagon brake that morning, and yet he was convicted of Sabbath breaking upon the evidence of that same Riley Warren. Meeks was thus virtually compelled to be a witness against himself, clearly another violation of both the state and United States Constitution. Sixth, Mr. Reeves's boys were hauling wood on Sunday. In the timber where they got the wood, they met another boy, a Seventh-day Adventist, John A. Meeks, hunting squirrels. They joined him in the hunt, scaring the squirrels around the trees so he could shoot them. Then the squirrels were divided between the Meeks boys and the Reeves boys. Then the Meeks boy was indicted, prosecuted, and convicted of Sabbath breaking upon the evidence of the father of those boys who were hauling wood and who helped kill the squirrels. Seventh, James M. Poole, for hoeing in his garden on Sunday, was convicted of Sabbath breaking on the evidence of a sanctified church member who had gone to Poole's house on Sunday to buy tobacco. Allow me to mention the methods of prosecution. In the case of Scholes, J.A. Armstrong was called before the grand jury. After repeated answers to questions in regard to work done on Sunday by different parties in several different lines of business and traffic, he was asked a direct question whether he knew of any Seventh-day Adventists who worked on Sunday, and when in the nature of the case he answered in the affirmative, every one of the Seventh-day Adventists whom he named was indicted and not one of any other class or trade. In the second case of James A. Armstrong, who was arrested at the instance of the mayor. When asked for the affidavit upon which Armstrong was arrested, the mayor said that A.J. Vaughn had called his attention to Armstrong's working and had said, quote, "Now see that you do your duty," close quote. Yet Vaughn testified under oath that he did not see Armstrong at all on the day referred to. Armstrong was not only arrested at the instance of the mayor, but he was also tried before the mayor, who acted as justice of the peace. And when Vaughn testified that he had not seen Armstrong at all on the day referred to, this made the mayor virtually both prosecuting witness and judge, and the questions which he asked showed that that was precisely his position and his own view of the case. The question which he asked to each of the first two witnesses was, quote, "What do you know about Mr. Armstrong's working on Sunday, June 27th? Close quote. This question assumes all that was expected to be proved on the trial. This is enough to show the workings of such a Sunday law as is embodied in this Senate bill. There were many other cases, every one in the same line. But throughout the whole list of cases, it is only the record of how people who were performing honest labor on their own premises in a way which was impossible to do harm to any soul on earth were indicted, prosecuted, and convicted upon the evidence of men who, if there were any wrong involved in the case at all, were more guilty than they. If religious persecution could possibly be more clearly demonstrated than it is in this thing, we hope never to see an illustration of it. It may be asked, why was not an appeal taken? An appeal was taken to the Supreme Court of the state in the first case that was tried. The judgment of the lower court was confirmed in an opinion closing with these words, quote, "The appellate's argument then is reduced to this, that because he conscientiously believes he is permitted by the law of God to labor on Sunday, he may violate with impunity the statute declaring it illegal to do so. But a man's religious belief cannot be accepted as a justification for his committing an overt act made criminal by the law of the land. If the law operates harshly, as laws sometimes do, the remedy is in the hands of the legislator. It is not the province of the judiciary to pass upon the wisdom or policy of legislation. That is for the members of the legislative department, and the only appeal from their determination is to the constituency, close quote. This decision of the Supreme Court is of the same piece with the prosecutions and judicial processes throughout. It gives to the legislature all the omnipotence of the British Parliament, and in that does away with all necessity for a constitution. The decision on this principle alone is un-American. No legislative body in this country is framed upon the model of the British Parliament in respect to power. In this country, the powers of every legislator are defined and limited by constitutions. It is the prerogative of Supreme Courts to define the meaning of the Constitution and to decide whether an act of the legislature is constitutional or not. If the act is constitutional, then it must stand, whatever the results may be. And the Supreme Court is the body by which the constitutionality or the unconstitutionality of any statute is to be discovered. But if, as this decision declares, the legislature is omnipotent and that which it does must stand as law, then there is no use for a constitution. Quote, one of the objects for which the judiciary department is established is the protection of the constitutional rights of the citizens, close quote. So long as there is a constitution above the legislature, which defines and limits its powers and protects and guards the rights of the citizens, so long it is the province of the Supreme Court to pronounce upon the acts of the legislature. The Supreme Court of Arkansas, therefore, in this case, clearly abdicated one of the very functions for which it was created, or else subverted the Constitution of Arkansas, and in either case bestowed upon the legislature the omnipotence of the British Parliament, which is contrary to every principle of American institutions. Nor is the state of Arkansas an exception in this case. For this is the usual procedure of Supreme Courts in sustaining Sunday laws. They cannot be sustained upon any American principle. Resort has to be made in every instance, and has been with scarcely an exception, either to the church and state principles of the British government, or to the British principle of the omnipotence of the legislative power. But American principles are far above and far in advance of the principles of the British government in that they recognize constitutional limitations upon the legislative power and countenance no union of church and state. Consequently, Sunday laws never have been and never can be sustained upon American principles. That this stricture upon Supreme Court of Arkansas is not unjust, we have the clearest proof. The three judges who then composed the Supreme Court were all members of the Bar Association of the State of Arkansas. In less than 3 months after this decision was rendered, the Bar Association unanimously made a report to the state on law and law reform, an official copy of which I have in my possession. In that report, under the heading Sunday Laws, is the following, quote, our statute, as it stands in Mansfield's Digest, provides that persons who are members of any religious society, who observe as Sabbath any other day of the week than the Christian Sabbath or Sunday, shall not be subject to the penalties of this act, the Sunday law, so that they observe one day in seven agreeably to the faith and practice of their church or society. Close quote. Quote, this statute had been in force from the time of the organization of the state government, but it was unfortunately repealed by an act of March 3rd, 1885. While the Jews adhere, of course, to the letter of the original command to remember the seventh day of the week, there is also in this state a small but respectable body of Christians who consistently believe that the seventh day is the proper day to be kept sacred, and in the case of Scholes versus State, our Supreme Court was compelled to affirm a judgment against a member of one of these churches for worshiping God according to the dictates of his own conscience, supported, as he supposed, by good theological arguments. It is very evident that the system now in force, savoring, as it does, very much of religious persecution, is a relic of the Middle Ages, when it was thought that men could be made orthodox by an act of parliament. Even in Massachusetts, where Sabbatarian laws have always been enforced with unusual vigor, exceptions are made in favor of persons who religiously observe any other day in the place of Sunday. We think that the law as it stood in Mansfield's Digest should be restored with such an amendment as would prevent the sale of spirits on Sunday, as that was probably the object of repealing the above section, close quote. Now the Arkansas Constitution says, quote, all men have a natural and indefeasible right to worship. Almighty God, according to the dictates of their own consciences, no man can of right be compelled to attend, erect, or support any place of worship, or to maintain any ministry against his consent. No human authority can, in any case or manner whatsoever, control or interfere with the right of conscience, and no preference shall ever be given by law to any religious establishment, denomination, or mode of worship above any other, close quote. This report of the Bar Association says, quote, in the case of Scholes versus State, our Supreme Court was compelled to affirm a judgment against a member of one of these churches for worshiping God according to the dictates of his own conscience, close quote. The members of the Supreme Court being members of the Bar Association, in that report, it is confessed that they confirmed a judgment against a man for doing that which the Constitution explicitly declares all men have a natural and indefeasible right to do. This is the end of Part 5.